It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. On Second Thought is paying tribute to our former host, Celeste Headlee, who stepped down last week. She helped launch this show on October the 20th, 2014, and we are marking the occasion of her departure by listening back to some of her best conversations from over the last 3.5 years. Today, we hear from author Salman Rushdie and comedian Colin Mochrie. But first, we talked recently about grocery stores closing in downtown Augusta and what it means to be in a food desert.
It's not just that there's a lack of access to fresh and healthy foods. It's sometimes there's more access to unhealthy foods, and that helps to contribute to the obesity epidemic.
That's Dr. Garth Graham from the Aetna Foundation. Here are your first thoughts. Catherine Cummings tweeted, "Food deserts are a bigger problem in rural areas than urban. People are easily more than 10 miles from fresh food with no public transportation."
My name is Kenneth Job. I'm from Roberta, Georgia. They closed the Piggly Wiggly here in Roberta, and the nearest grocery store is 15 miles away or 20 minutes by car. So that's created quite a food desert here for the people in Crawford County.
Well, we always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Colin Mochrie may have one of the fastest minds around. The comedian is best known for his role on Whose Line Is It Anyway? Audiences in Atlanta can see him live on March 16th at Dad's Garage. Celeste Headlee talked to him last year.
When did you first suspect you might be good at improv? Like, when did you first think, hey, this is my niche?
Oh, well, there wasn't a time. When I was growing up, it didn't exist. So it wasn't until I first saw improv, some friends were demonstrating it. I thought, oh, this will be interesting to try out. You don't really have to learn anything. You just make up crap. I can do that. And I took a workshop and found that I really had an affinity for it. And so it just became something I loved doing. And I never thought, oh, this is going to be my career. So it's really worked out nicely for me.
I mean, obviously, you have to practice and rehearse improv quite a lot, which seems antithetical, but it's not. But do you think an improvisation pro is born or made?
Oh, well, I think anyone can do improv. I mean, all our lives are improvised. So basically, the two rules are doing the things that we don't do in real life, which is listening and accepting other people's ideas. That is the hardest hurdle for new improvisers to get over. There's that thing, and that's where, no, my idea is better. And once you learn to let that go, you can be a good improviser. I think the humor aspect, I think you're born with it. I don't think anyone... classes could make you funnier. They can't make you funny. You have to have that, I think, to begin with.
Let's hear from the late comic Del Close. He's often called the father of long-form improv. He played a big role in forming Second City. Here he is speaking in 1970. He's talking to the legendary journalist Studs Terkel and explaining why he thinks improv is more than just sketch comedy.
The theater of psychology, the theater of feeling, is very much on the way out. And it's only through action that we understand someone, not through what they tell us about themselves. No soliloquy is going to reveal nearly so much about what the guy does as what he does after the soliloquy, what the guy's like, rather. And that's what I'm trying to get to in improvisation as well.
So how do you, when you're practicing improv, how do you balance the verbal, what you're saying, and you're so good at the one-liners, right, mm-hmm. with the physicality that he's talking about?
You know, it all depends on the scene. You know, most of the, I don't really practice improv. What I do is try to get to a state where I'm just totally relaxed on walking out onto a stage in front of an audience who have paid good money to see a show that I don't have at that moment. So you're open to everything that comes along. And then your body and mind go into sort of a survival mode where you start physicalizing very, like, even the smallest moment can get a laugh and get an audience to go, I know that movement, I know that person, I know that situation. It just becomes an organic thing that you and your partners sort of start to breathe together and make this living scene. It's such a bizarre art form, because it truly just lasts for that moment. If you saw someone say, you know, I saw this really funny show last night. The guy walked like a duck. And you go, well, what? You had to be there to see the entire process and why that was funny at that moment. It really is such a, it's like a firefly or something. It just lives for that 2 hours and then it's gone forever.
Although there are people who watch reruns of Whose Line Is It Away endlessly. Here's a pretty popular sketch. One of the sketches that you did numerous times on that show was where you played a news anchor, and each time you had a different name. Here are a few of those names.
Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Arthur Any More Donuts. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Earl from Ipanema. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Wolverine St. Jack John. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Lars of the Red Hot Lovers.
You shook her. You shook.
It's just sad when you hear them all in a row. Oh, the career is gone now.
I mean, do you often go back and listen to improvisation or sketches that you've done?
No. There are times where I'll be, you know, clicking channels and I'll see a Who's Line and watch it. And it's I'm watching as an audience because I have no memory of that particular scene. The only one, and now I don't know if I know it because I remember, or I've just seen it so many times, is the Richard Simmons scene where I use him as a jet ski that... yet to be there.
Well, actually, we have a little clip of that also. We first hear Drew Carey introducing everyone.
Let's continue the show with a game called, I love this game, Living Scenery. This is for Ryan, Colin, and Wayne. And Richard Simmons, everybody. Richard Simmons. Ryan and Colin are going to act out a scene. During the scene, they have to use a number of props. However, since they don't have any real props to work with
I'll
tonight.
I'll be the prop.
Right, Wayne and Richard.
He was so committed.
Yes.
You've got to love that.
What makes a good partner in improv? I mean, you've already said somebody who listens and responds, right? Mm-hmm. Is that basically all that you need?
That's it. And trust, someone that you totally trust. You know, I work with Ryan Stiles a lot, and I tour with Brad Sherwood. Both those guys, I usually know where they're going to go in a scene. But when I don't, I trust them both enough to just follow along and see what's going to happen. So trust is a big part.
So when you're doing improv, I mean, improv, I assume, is a relative, based on whatever shows I've been to, they seem to be a relatively diverse crowd of, mm-hmm. of people. And I wonder how you deal then with controversial subjects, or if you steer away from them. It's hard these days because almost everything becomes political, right?
Yeah.
But do you hesitate before you bring up a joke or a line that might be controversial?
We try. Brad Sherwood and I have been touring for 15 years. And lately, we've actually started off the show saying, we would like to keep this a political-free show. We're just doing goofy stuff. So please, let's not mention just the current events. Because I don't know, in an improv setting, we can bring justice to what the suggestion is. You know, there are so many great satirical, political satirists out there who can make a point. Our thing would be, well, this is stupid. And then it'd be hard to sort of build on that. And it's not what we do. We're just there to have goofy fun. We throw little things out. But we started to notice during the Bush administration, there was one night Brad made a totally innocuous Bush joke, and the audience was immediately divided in half. And it was like, wow, how did this happen? Americans love making fun of their presidents. And it's just gotten actually worse since then. So we made this choice, just let's keep away from it. It's not what our show is mainly about. And it's really not worth it for that one little moment to suddenly split up our audience.
And that's very different. That's a clear dividing line between how vocal you may or may not be in your personal life as opposed to what you do on stage. And that's especially true. You've been quite public in support of your transgender daughter. You tweeted, quote, "My 90-year-old mother-in-law and 87-year-old mother love and acceptance of our trans daughter warms me. Wonder why some who are younger can't," end quote. So here's an actual comment from the CBC, an interview of your daughter, Kinley, talking about her transition.
I had come out to my mom. My dad was out of town, and it was a lot of conversations, getting all the information, making sure we were on even playing field. It took some time, but I knew that support and acceptance was on the other side. I was not worried for a second.
How do you separate those kind of things? And obviously, transgender issues are very much in the political and public eye, extremely controversial. So how do you successfully keep those separate?
It's just something I've done. I've always sort of kept my professional and private life separate. I mean, except for the fact that I'm known from television, I think people would be surprised if they didn't know me that I was in the entertainment business, because I'm very quiet. I'm very shy. I tend to listen more than actually start conversations. So I always kept those two things. My wife calls the guy on Whose Line the other, because it is nothing like the man she has married, which is great, because I think that would be very tiring to be married to someone who is on all the time. So that's a totally separate issue. And my private life, transgender politics is something I've obviously become involved in lately because of personal experience. And just, you know, it's 2017. I've missed a year. I really feel we should be in the Star Trek part of our life, where everyone has gotten together, we're all doing fine, and now we're heading off into find other worlds to screw up and keep this one good. I think it's ridiculous that we still have to work on gender and race and sexual politics at this time where we have so much information. Maybe we have too much information. It's hard for people to sort of figure out what the truth is and what is just stuff that's thrown out there. So when I do talk about it, it is from my personal life, and something I feel very passionate about. And, you know, I'm not going to change a lot of people's perceptions about this, but if I can get a conversation starting, you know, that's a beginning.
In the 30 seconds that we have left, what is the role then for comedy in a time when even a joke divides people?
I think you know people like Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and John Oliver, we need those guys, because they're showing the idiocy of the world, of the government, of the people who are in power, and we need that to sort of keep them honest as much as we can. You know, I don't think a comedy show can completely save the world, but it can get people thinking and get them out there and make them want a better world, a world where we can laugh maybe about other things at some point, where, you know, the biggest joke will be about a puppy.
That's comic Colin Mochrie speaking with former On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee. Still not used to saying former. Colin performs on March 16th at 8 p.m. at Dad's Garage in Atlanta. For more details and to watch Colin's past performances, visit gpbnews.org. We continue to look back at some of the best conversations by Celeste Headlee. She stepped down last week as host of this program. Just ahead, we revisit her conversation with Salman Rushdie. But first, the voice behind Siri. This is On Second Thought.
I built a friend with three pieces of plastic and a pen. I made him on the table in the den. I gave him my old cell phone for a head, for a head. And we spent holidays in my house, and we left presents in a stocking, and we bought bolts and things and strings and a new watch. That's what he got. And we had so much fun together. We knew we'd be friends forever. And we had so much fun together. We had so much fun.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. All this hour, we're looking back at some of the best conversations hosted by former On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee. She stepped down as host of this program last week. Every so often, Celeste and her team tried out some new segments. Some would last while others were one-hit wonders. This next conversation is an example of the latter. In 2016, we began a series called No Notes. The On Second Thought producers would find a guest who had a great story to tell, but Celeste didn't know anything about the guest prior to the interview. She would have to figure it out along the way. The first of the only two people we tried this with is a person with a famous voice, but she does not have a household name. Here is Celeste.
So I was sitting in the studio when a woman walked in, short hair, colorful vest.
I'm ready, I think.
She's a very good sport.
More? Testing, testing. Hello.
Okay. So tell me your name.
My name is Susan Bennett.
And Susan, you're here to tell me a story that I do not know.
I am.
So let's start at the beginning of the story. Where did this event or occurrence begin?
It actually began in Atlanta 10 years ago, and it didn't really come to fruition or public knowledge until many years later.
So how did it get started 10 years ago?
It had to do with a recording.
A recording of?
Of my voice.
You're a singer.
I'm a singer, and I'm a voice talent.
Okay. So what were you singing?
Well, at the time, I had a band called Interactive, which was a private event band. And we worked all over the city and all over the Southeast, actually.
A private event, meaning you did parties and...
Parties, yes.
Conventions.
Yes, conventions. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Okay. And
yeah.
Is it significant, the song you were singing?
No.
Okay.
In no way.
But you were with your band Interactive and you made this recording.
No, I was referring to recording of voice work. Yeah.
Oh, you do voiceovers.
I'm a voiceover person, yes.
And you were all the way back in 10 years ago.
Oh, way back farther than that.
Okay,
yes.
So what were you voicing?
What was I voicing?
Yeah.
Is this the part where I make the big revelation?
Got to answer my questions.
Okay. I was voicing what I thought was phone messaging.
Phone messaging?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you get called for a gig, and you go into a studio, and what's the kind of thing they were asking you to say?
Well, I was actually working for a company that I had worked for a long time and still work for, and they do a lot of messaging and informative types of messages.
Are you talking about like when you call a company and they say, you are the fourth person in line, your call is important to us?
That's something very similar to that, yes.
Okay, so
yeah.
Give me an example of something you voiced for them.
I'm the voice of a lot of different banks.
Right.
And Dell Computer.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and I'm the voice of Delta Airlines Gates Worldwide.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 10 years ago, you got called in for a gig to do what you thought was phone messaging.
Mm-hmm.
So did you not have a script or know what you were going to be saying?
I had a script, but it was different than other scripts because it was not... the sentences weren't created for content. They were created for sound. They were trying to get all of the sound combinations in the language.
So then they could take those sounds and create their own words?
Yes, create their own sentences, their own phrases.
Do you remember a phrase that you had to say for them?
I certainly do.
Okay, tell me one.
Militia oi hallucinate, buckra okra ooze. Or here's a beautiful one. Say the shrouding again. Say the shrouding again. Say the shrieding again. Say the shrouding again.
How long were you in the studio doing this
way
nonsense?
Long. Way too long.
Hours.
Four hours a day, 5 days a week for an entire month. That was the initial vocabulary.
So you're standing there. I mean, that can be very tough on your voice.
Yes, it was. Yes, I really wasn't able to do too much. Other than that recording at the time, but it was July. It was the month of July, and there
so it's
and that's
humid,
a,
that's
kind
good.
Of a well, it's kind of a slow time, too. You know,
but people don't realize how fatiguing it is on the voice actually to talk for 4 hours.
Well, particularly that type of thing because every single sentence and phrase had to be read in the same way, the same pacing, the same pitch, the same tone, the same intonation, because they were going to go in afterwards and extract sounds. So it had to be as consistent as possible. So on the one hand, it's probably as far away from creative as you could get. But on the other hand, it was challenging because you really had to fit those parameters.
I feel like we're getting to the point where you're about to tell me what this was used for. I'm going to say, oh, my gosh, I use that all the time.
Yes.
But before we get there, do you know how you got the gig? I mean, what were they looking for? What did they like in your voice?
I don't know. I think it was probably because... my voice can sound pleasant, but authoritative and articulate.
Okay.
Articulation was quite important. They manipulated the voice after the recordings were done to make it sound a certain way for them.
Okay, it has to be something like Google Maps, right? I mean,
Similar.
Did you buy the product?
Eventually.
Eventually, but you didn't write, that's not how you found out. How did you find out?
A fellow voice actor emailed me and said, hey, we're listening to this. Isn't this you?
So somebody recognized it.
Somebody
even
recognized
though it was not
it.
Things you'd ever said in real life.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, they just recognized the sound of my voice.
All right. What's the product?
I'm the original voice of Siri.
Okay. And you're from Georgia?
I'm from Atlanta, yes.
Okay, so, I mean, one thing is that you couldn't have had a Georgia accent in order for them to pick you.
Correct. Well, I'm not from Georgia. I'm from New England.
Which makes sense. Which but you can't even have a New England accent.
Right, there's a very thick accent there, too. Yes, I was fortunate enough in the sixth grade to move to upstate New York, where their accent, there's a very small accent. They're kind of on their way to the Midwest, so there's they say fast instead of fast. But I lost the New England accent there and got much more of a neutral accent. And then once I started doing voice work, I was very careful not to attain any other type of accent.
Did you purposely lose that accent?
No, it just happened naturally. It was just sort of
But you made sure that it stayed away.
I think it was in the plan, to tell you the truth.
Okay, so do you own an Apple product now?
Of course, yes.
And do you make yourself say things all the time?
No.
I would be doing that all day long.
No, no, you wouldn't.
No, really?
No, it's very, very strange. I was used to hearing my voice on radio and TV commercials or in, you know, instructional videos and documentaries and things like that. But to have your voice come out of this little tiny computerized phone system that you hold in your hand and have it be an actual persona. It wasn't just a voice. It was Siri.
Yeah.
And she's iconic.
And she's a little bit sassy.
She's very sassy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's jealous of other voice-activated programs.
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, I've had a lot of fun playing that voice. I did that in a contest between Siri and Alexa for Jimmy Kimmel. Oh, that was really fun. Yeah, Siri always wins.
Siri does always win.
Siri
kind of.
Always wins.
And
yes.
She knows what you really
yes.
meant.
Yes.
So, for the 6 years that were happening between, did you know, when they hired you, did you know it was Apple?
No, no. Apple came in after the fact. All of these original recordings were done for a company that was called ScanSoft and became Nuance. And it's the biggest text-to-speech company in the world. So they're the biggest group that does this process called concatenation, which is they take your voice and they, you know, take little snippets of sound from it and make your voice say other things that you may not ever have said in your whole life or want to say.
Yeah, Siri doesn't swear, though.
Well, you just have never heard her.
Siri does swear? Oh, I know people have spent a huge amount of time trying to make her swear.
Oh, listen, I'm sorry. Siri has a secret life, so, you know.
but now that you're Siri and a recognizable voice, you can't be somebody else's voice of their program, right?
Well,
let me ask that a different way. Are you contractually obligated to not do this for someone else?
No, and that's the reason why all of the original Siri voices worldwide were changed with the OS 7 system. So it's no longer my voice, and none of us had non-disclosure agreements. And I think
it's still my voice because I have an old iPad. But
oh, good.
I mean, I still have you.
Well, you have the better voice. Yeah. And so, I think the newer voices are a little less, maybe have a little less dry sense of humor, a little more generic. And of course, now the current series now say things like text, what I call text speech, like LOL instead of laughing.
Oh, right.
You know, of course, I always say, how would Siri laugh? That could be scary.
Yeah. Do you still sing? Have you kept these two
I
careers going at
yes.
the same time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, What voice part are you? Are you an alto?
I am an alto now. I used to be a soprano.
So when Siri was recorded, were you a soprano, a higher voice?
Probably.
Because it sounds like you still have a little bit of that bass in your voice. Siri does anyway.
Oh, I can. Yeah, and yeah. I can also sound like this. You know, that's the thing about voice talent, and one of the reasons why it took me a really long time to reveal myself as Siri, because as a voice actor, we're used to being invisible and anonymous, and for the most, usually that is in our favor, because it's like the TV show The Voice. When we do an audition, people don't know what we look like, where we're from, any
of that.
You
mean the part because they have their backs turned?
Right. Yeah. So the talent is being judged just on their voice and their performance. And so I knew that once I became Siri, it seems to be human nature to stereotype people. And so I knew once I revealed myself as Siri, I would have nothing but Siri jobs. You know,
is that turned out to be the case?
Mostly, yeah.
Really?
Yes, it's disappointing. But I think we're in that ADD culture where people really don't take the time to investigate what else you can do. And so you have to kind of hit them over the head to display what other things you can do.
All right. So I got to ask you, can you say this is On Second Thought from GPB News as Siri for me?
Not unless you pay me.
I got a quarter.
No, that won't do it. No, no.
Siri, damn it, this is public radio. We don't have any money.
No, I can say, I've enjoyed talking to you, Celeste. Bye-bye now.
That was voiceover actress Susan Bennett, who was the original Siri. She spoke with former On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee in 2016. That interview was originally produced for a series called No Notes. It was something we tried out on Second Thought, but it never really stayed around the show. Now let's listen to a series that has stood the test of time. In 2014, we launched a music series called the Georgia Playlist. The rules are simple. We ask people connected to Georgia's music industry to talk about their two favorite songs by other Georgia artists. On tomorrow's show, we will revisit Celeste Headlee's conversation with Kate Pearson of the B-52s. But first, let's hear Kate Pearson's contribution to the Georgia Playlist.
One, two, one, two, three.
Hi, my name is Kate Pearson from the B-52s, and also from Kate Pearson, Guitars and Microphones, my solo record. My first choice of songs from a Georgia artist, Augusta G.A., Hot Pants, James Brown.
Take your pants off on, it looks much better time, my people keep going.
James Brown is unique, and he's just, there's just something raw and beautiful and just ever, you know, it's eternal. You know, it's like it doesn't age. That song does not age. It doesn't ever sound old, any of James Brown's stuff, you know, and I think a lot of artists feel that way, that he's on one of the top of the list.
Hot pants make you shield yourself. Good God, you won't like.
Back in the day when the B-52s started, we would dance at the drop of a hat. We'd go over to our friend John Taylor's house. He'd bake cornbread. He was always cooking, so we gravitated to his house. And he'd put on James Brown or Shotgun or something, and we would just dance around the table. We would dance with that cornbread. We would dance, you know, in the middle of the day. So James Brown was one of those people that you could not stop dancing. If Hot Pants was on, you had to get up and dance. Hot pants, smoking. Okay, the second song on my list of Georgia artists from Macon, Georgia, Tutti Frutti by Little Richard. The same kind of thing with as James Brown in a way. You can't stop dancing, and he's also sort of the king of rock and roll, or the one of the fathers of rock and roll. It's one of those songs that you could say, okay, the lyrics really are genius in their simplicity.
She rock to the east, she rock to the west, but she's the girl that I love best.
You know, do people just say like, oh, what do these crazy lyrics mean? You know, sometimes they'll take B-52 songs out of context and, you know, they'll read the lyrics and say, this is just so like, how can this be a song? But, you know, this is an example of these lyrics, which apparently he got from some teenage girl, I think he heard, overheard, or she said Tutti Frutti. But, you know, you get your inspiration from wherever. But, I mean, that is just so genius the way he put that together. And it's just in some ways nonsense, but in some ways it's the most profound thing you could ever sing. Tutti Frutti. Oh, Rudy. Tutti Frutti. Nobody could sing like a Little Richard. He's one of a kind. Also, like growing up, you know, gay and Macon, I mean, he's got to be like made of some tough stuff. And I think he's just, you know, just such a brave person to grow up, you know, and do the music he did. And I just think he blazed a trail. I don't think there's one particular sound for the state. No, there's just Athens is a unique sound. I think Macon had its sound, certainly. And there's I think the really big rap scene in Atlanta. So there's an Atlanta sound, I think, too. And there's a lot of creativity in Georgia.
That's singer-songwriter Kate Pearson of the B-52s with her picks for our ever-growing Essential Georgia playlist. Kate picked music superstars of Augusta and Macon, but we all know that she's Athens all the way. All this hour, we are looking back at some of our favorite conversations done by former On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee. Just ahead, author Salman Rushdie. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. All this hour, we're looking back at some of the best interviews by Celeste Headlee. She stepped down last week as host of this program. One of her favorite conversations was with the writer Salman Rushdie. He's the author of more than a dozen novels. Celeste spoke to him in 2015.
The one person I have interviewed more than any other during my nearly 20 years in radio is my next guest. Salman Rushdie is the author of 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. Salman Rushdie joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Hello there. Yeah, this is getting to be an old relationship.
Well, the thing I love about talking to you is that I don't have to do any preparation other than read your books.
Oh, that's good. Reading the books is good.
Well, I wanted to talk about the most controversial thing here, you know.
Yes.
And that's that you don't use the Oxford comma.
Oh, you know, it's a funny thing that there's of course, as you know, a big argument.
Yeah.
Between the Americans and the British about this.
Yes.
And I think in this particular case, the British won. I have no strong feelings on the subject, you know. For example, when I publish stories in, for example, the New Yorker magazine, there always is an Oxford comma. So I go along with the majority opinion on this. I have no strong opinion.
All right. Well, then, you know, I want to talk about the book because it seems to me almost it's almost describing what happens when human beings become afraid and the best and worst that comes out of us. And it made me wonder, the whole time I was reading, when did you begin writing it? Was there a specific calamity, catastrophe that came to mind?
No, I started writing it, I guess, over 3 years ago. And in fact, I just worked out the other day, which slightly spooked me, that the length of time it took to write was about exactly the length of time in the title.
Ugh. Really?
Yeah. I mean, somebody asked me, how long did you spend writing this book? And so I thought, well, let me work that out. And I thought, yeah, it was 2 years and 8 months and 3 weeks or so. Oh, my goodness. You know, it's exactly the same length of time that is described in the title. So there's something very odd about that.
Well, that's 1,001 nights. And that wasn't my other question was whether you decided you were going to write a book that featured the jinn in it, or you decided you were going to write a book about the 1,001 Arabian Nights. Which came first?
Well, in terms of storytelling, I wanted to write something which was very fantasticated. You know, I mean, the book before this was the opposite of this. The book before this was
a memoir.
Was a memoir, and I'd spent the previous, you know, those three years, trying as hard as I could not to have anything made up, you know, to try and tell the truth. And then I thought, I want to get back to what I really like most, which is making up stories, and let me go to the other end of the spectrum and started making up something very, very extreme. And yes, it comes out of my childhood, really, which is when I first encountered all these wonderful tales, which the Arabian Nights is just the most famous compendium, but not the only one. And I thought, let me try and tell a story like that, but set in mostly in New York. I mean, it's as if I arrived in New York with all these stories in my baggage. And I thought, let me see what happens if I unpack the bags and, you know, kind of throw these genies at Manhattan.
You know, you actually kind of almost warn readers about the dangers of fiction. I want to read a little piece from it. You say, "The thing I'm thinking is that all these stories are fiction," she said. "Even the ones that insist on being facts, like who was where first and whose God had precedence over whose, they're all make-believe. Fantasies, the realist fantasies and the fantastic fantasies are both made up. And the first thing to know about made-up stories is that they're all untrue in the same way." Is that a warning about how to read your novels?
Well, I think one of the great things about growing up in this world of fairy tale and fable is that it teaches you very early in your life that fiction is fictional. You know, that the illusion that fiction is real, which realist novelists try and foist on us, you know, is just another kind of illusion. And once you have that in your mind, it kind of sets you free. Then carpets can start flying, you know. And actually, I think there actually is a flying carpet or two in this book.
There is, although she complains about it. And and I mean, I think this is one of the things that I made a mistake by reading a bunch of reviews before I actually read the book. But the thing that I miss all the time is that people don't talk about how funny your books are. I mean, they're really funny, and there's a lot of jokes, like out-and-out jokes. And I wonder if you're ever sitting there thinking, oh, I better take this joke out because I'm literature with a capital L.
No, I really have no sense of being literature with a capital L. I mean, I prefer to just write. I mean, I like books that are funny. You know, I mean, to speak as a reader, I have some difficulty with even the greatest books if they are completely lacking in a sense of humor. And, you know, I'm looking at you, George Eliot. I have had in my life some real trouble with Middlemarch.
I enjoyed it, but it is a slog.
Yeah, there's no gags in Middlemarch, you know.
There aren't, and there's a lot of gags. And I mean, I love the part where you describe now Mr. Geronimo, which ironically you point out that he has to say that he's India from Indian. India instead of Indian, yeah. Native American, and yet you've named him after the great Apache chief. But he starts floating above the ground, and then you describe him as a down-to-earth man.
Well, that's what I think. That's the kind of comedy of him. Yes, and talking about the two kinds of Indian, you know, I think we have to sometimes agree to use the formulation of dot, not feather, you know. and he gets named after feather, not dot, so that's his one of his problems. It's not his biggest problem. His biggest problem is coming unstuck from the earth. And I thought the fact that he's a gardener, you know, he's somebody who's dedicated his life to the care of the earth, to nurturing the soil and things that grow out of it, and that for that person to suddenly see that his feet don't touch the ground anymore is first of all it's funny, but it also it's poignant, I hope, you know. It gives him a real problem, but it also gives him that double thing of being both a comic figure and a tragic figure.
The thing is, though, that within all that comedy, and it is through the entire book, I think that's one of the things I really enjoy about your writing, is there really is this sort of serious thread in there. And I loved what Ursula K. Le Guin said about you. She said, "Rushdie is a generous, good-natured writer who'd rather woo and seduce his readers than reduce the truth to gall and brimstone and make them swallow it."
Ursula Le Guin, I have to say, has been hanging in there for me from the very, very beginning. I mean, from my very first novel, Grimus, which was published 40 years ago, she wrote kind of the most generous review of that book, and here she is again. I mean, I think I owe her quite a bit.
And there is, behind all this irony, although you put it in a way that is easy to read, I want to read this other passage. You say, all these crazy things are going on in New York, as you say, these incredible storms, a sea monster rises up out of the water and swallows a ferry boat with all the passengers on it. And one of the characters is upset by this, and you write, she was familiar with a certain type of American crazy. Gun crazy was normal to her, shooting at kids at school, or putting on a Joker mask and mowing people down in a mall, or just plain murdering your mom at breakfast crazy, Second Amendment crazy. That was just the everyday crazy that kept going down, and there was nothing you could do about it if you loved freedom. And there, to me, it feels like the crux of the book. And I wonder how you went about trying to deliver this message about what is crazy and what is normal in a readable way.
I mean, that is, you know, that is somewhere near the heart of the book, because what I thought is that the world is crazy right now. You know, that all kinds of bizarre and not just violent, but including violent things happen every day. And I think many people have that sense of the world having changed very, very fast and continuing to change very, very fast and having become a strange place. A lot of people, I think, feel a little bewildered and alienated by the rate of change. And I thought, well, let me take that feeling that genuinely exists, I think, and see how I can make a story about it, which in a way encapsulates or turns into fairy tale that true feeling.
And you use I found it interesting you use the word supranormal and not supernatural. Why?
Well, because supernatural is creatures in white sheets. You know, supernatural is Ghostbusters. I mean, even though there actually is a reference to Ghostbusters.
There is.
But I think supernatural people associate with, you know, ghosts, spooks. And this is something else. This is suggesting just that what we think of as normal ain't normal anymore. You know, the world has become such a bizarre place that there are these other levels which feel almost surrealist, except they're really happening, whether we're talking about technological revolution or war or fanaticism or the various kinds of crazy that were in that passage that you read.
And speaking of fanaticism, which is kind of another really deep theme in the book, at one point you have the philosopher Ibn Rushd say, "You will see as time goes by that in the end it will be religion that will make men turn away from God. The godly are God's worst advocates. It may take 1,001 years, but in the end religion will shrivel away and only then will we begin to live in God's truth." So is this book anti-religion?
Well, I mean, it's against certainly a number of things done in the name of religion, you know, all of which we can see on the news every day. But what it suggests, and it's something that I've often thought, is that religion might be something that people outgrow. You know, I think that, interestingly, many of the old polytheistic religions contain that idea. You know, in the old Greek and Roman myths, there actually is a moment that comes when the Greek and Roman gods, who have previously been interfering on an almost daily basis in human life, taking sides in the Trojan War and so on, but there's a moment when they simply withdraw. They go back to Olympus and they leave the human race to its own devices. There's a similar moment in the Norse mythology where the gods actually have to engage in the battle, which is normally known as the Twilight of the Gods, in which they battle and destroy their adversaries, but are also destroyed by them. And after that, the human race has to live in a world in which the gods are no longer there. So this is an idea that's quite an old idea, that human beings, the human race at some point, outgrows the gods or the gods withdraw, and then we're just left to ourselves. And I think, you know, I think there's something good about that.
You're listening to an interview with author Salman Rushdie. He spoke to now former On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee in 2015.
Salman Rushdie is the author of 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. All right. For all of your intellect, which no one's going to argue with, your books reveal you to be such a softie. And I mean, what saves the world in this book is love. One of the djinn
yes.
learns how to love. And one of the things I love in this book is that listening is actually magic.
Yes. You listen, and women, by the way, very good at it. It's the female djinn in the novel who is a mistress of the art of listening, where she can put her ear to your chest and know exactly your heart's desire, you know exactly what's going on inside you. I think writers have to be good listeners, you know. I think one of the things you have to be able to do as a writer is hear what people are really saying, you know, and be able to represent that. So yes, listening is great magic. It's softy magic, maybe.
You know, it's kind of surreal. I have to imagine it's surreal to be a quote-unquote celebrity author.
I mean, people say that, but actually in my daily life, it doesn't really impinge very much. You know, I mean, a writer's life, it requires you to be alone in a room a great deal of the time. Otherwise, the books don't get written. And also the books themselves, you know, writing is very hard to do, and it keeps you honest. You know, you can't really have a very inflated idea of yourself when every day you're facing the limits of your own talent. You know, so, I mean, yes, it gets me seats at Yankee games and tables at restaurants, but that's about it.
But it means that you end up getting asked questions all the time that are unrelated to your writing. And I wonder
yes.
about all the political questions you get asked, because it's a lot. Do you ever worry about giving your political opinion?
No, I mean, I started out being a writer with an interest in politics, but, you know, be careful what you wish for, I guess, which is one of the messages of this book. And I more and more feel that I wish I could withdraw from that. I don't want to be a kind of political talking head. That's not why I got into this game at all. I got into this game to make up stories that would please people and delight people and hopefully leave them with something that they valued. That's the only thing I'm trying to do. And I hope that's what people take from this book. I mean, one of the pleasures of the early weeks of this book coming out is how much fun people seem to be having with it, you know, and that's really the best thing that I could hope for as a writer.
It's really funny. I tore through the pages. There's this one great line. I'm going to read it really quickly only because I found it so hilarious, in which you say, they're talking about a lightning storm, and then you write, nobody killed, thank goodness, except for the idiot who decided the best place to shelter from thunderbolts was under a tree. He got fried. And I wonder, you know, it made me think of how fun it must be to read that. And it's, you're giving a reading, actually, at the Jimmy Carter Library tomorrow. So how do you pick what to read?
Well, you have to pick little bits that seem to make, you know, you have to offer people something that feels like a story you're telling them, you know. So you have to find bits that, relatively speaking, stand on their own as a passage.
But without giving anything away.
Well, I don't mind giving stuff away, but it's not like it's a whodunit, you know. But it's always difficult. And actually, in these first weeks, you know, after a book comes out, I mean, I'm still finding the readings. I'm still looking through the books, thinking, well, maybe that would be a good bit to read. I'm trying things out, you know, and seeing which ones go down best. So. Yeah, but it's fun, you know. There are writers who don't like reading their work, but I'm or who are not particularly good at it. But I mean, I've sort of a frustrated actor. The only other thing I ever wanted to be in my life was an actor, and this is as close as I get to doing it nowadays. So I enjoy it.
That's author Salman Rushdie. He spoke with Celeste Headlee in 2015. It was one of Celeste's favorite interviews that she did on this show. Celeste stepped down from this program last week. And that's it for our show today, but we want to hear from you as always. We're spending this entire week on Second Thought, listening back to some of the best conversations that Celeste Headlee did. You can call us at 404-500-9457. Let us know what are your favorites. You can also post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk, and we're, of course, on Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.